It's the Sedia Awesome Podcast, and we're back. And we finally have matches to talk about that are not the Coppa Italia. Because we've seen league matches, we've seen Juve disappoint, then delight, we've seen Inter come back into it. Will it be a three-horse race? Nobody knows. But with me to find out is, of course, Gabriele Marcotti and Nikki Bandini. How are you guys?
Very well.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, I'm Mina Rizuki, as you all know, and I have been, let's just say, a bit reflective this week because it's been a tough week for Juve. They've come in and out of a crisis. They played two games in the Coppa Italia where they didn't even score a goal. They couldn't even score penalties, guys. You know, like, let's be honest, this was tragic to say the least. But they did play Bologna on Monday night. They finally got back into the swing of things. They kept their energy up for 70 minutes, like Maurizio Sarri wants to remind us. And apparently all is well. And I just really want to turn around and be like, okay, they're better, fine. But it's still individual ability. And frankly, Bologna is a good side, but it's not a side that I'm going to be like, yeah, well done. This is, you know, this is the top six side. It's still Bologna. Am I still being too pessimistic?
Why don't we take the positives, right? So Cristiano Ronaldo's not playing center forward. That's good, right?
Well, he should have never played there.
I know, but does it mean that, you know, Sarri's kind of like one of those AI robots that learns from his mistakes? You know, a lot of talk about, and then Cristiano Ronaldo's very helpful sister comes out and just slams the team. Even suggestions that Cristiano had a talk with Sarri, which look, if he did, Borucci said they had a big team meeting or whatever. You know, that's good. It's normal. They should compare notes. I think even Sarri would realize that, you know, his Ronaldo at center forward experiment didn't work. I don't think Ronaldo played great, but overall, Dybala scored a great goal playing in centrally. And your boy Bernardeschi, I thought he was good. I don't understand why this guy gets all this criticism. Tell me, these are reasons to be happy, right? If you're a fan.
I thought it was really interesting performance from Bernardeschi. It's almost the most interesting of that front three. I mean, Gazzetta, of course, because they just can't help themselves with their need to smash players' names together. We're sort of celebrating this as the return of Dybala, the combination of those two names, Dybala and Ronaldo. But in some ways, I thought this was all about Bernardeschi, because that's the sort of the key change. I mean, Sadio's come back from this sort of mid-season interruption with an initial commitment to get Douglas Costa involved, to sort of have that be the new dynamic element of that attack. And we talked about it on last week's show, sort of what he can give you in terms of pace and the line breaking, perhaps. But Bernardeschi interpreted that role on the right of attack in a completely different way, in a way that I thought was really compelling in this game. Clearly, his through the legs heel flick for the assist on Dybala's goal was beautiful, almost as beautiful as the goal itself. I don't disagree with Mina still, but for me, this game still felt a lot like we were talking about what Sarri talked about after the cup final, which was individualism, players who were sort of doing things on their own. I thought that Bologna took a very different tack to what we saw Juventus' two opponents take in the Coppa. They actually played quite open. They tried to take the game to them. And there were a few moments early on, certainly with some very peculiar decisions being made with the passes in front of their own goal by certain Juventus centre-backs, that they made things look a bit hairy. But I do think
there's only two. Name names. There's only two, right?
Well, I mean, you know, I don't want to sort of call him out and suggest that he was awful games. I don't think he was. But De Ligt played one sort of particular chip back towards Chesney that I was watching with my sort of eyes bulging out of my head, because it was like a chip pass straight back at his goalkeeper, who dealt with it very, very well, by the way, with a attacker right on him. But yes, I felt that the way Bologna played slightly played into Juventus' hands, because Juventus had not done well against those two sort of packed midfields for Milan and Napoli. Whereas you look at that goal which Dybala scored, yes, it's ridiculously clever little flick from Bernardeschi. It's a beautifully taken goal, but there was more space for that to happen than there was perhaps in the last two games they played.
Well, they were also losing at home at that stage. So
yeah. That's true.
I think this is my fear, is the fact that, you know, one of the reasons why Juventus decided to get rid of Allegri was obviously because it just kind of looked like it was all about individual play, and there wasn't really this team ethic of playing this wonderful style of football to get the goals. And then you look at this team, and again, like, you know, what would have happened without that wonderful strike from Ronaldo? What would have happened if Bologna didn't make a mistake?
Dybala. I know it's a Freudian thing, but, you know, let's give the little guy credit, okay?
Dybala, my apologies. You know, what if he didn't strike that beautiful goal, or if Ronaldo didn't win that penalty? You know what it is? I think sometimes my brain is ahead of my my mouse, but anyway. It is dependent a lot on the times, on the beauty of their individuals. I do think Gilles, I know he makes mistakes, but I am proud of the way that he's settled in. I think that he's doing really well at the back, and him and Bonucci are pretty much the only guarantees I have. One of the things I hate about Juve is when they can't defend, and I can honestly say that's not something that I've worried about for a while. So at least on that level, I'm happy. With Werner, it's really funny because, I mean, I'm reading all these things about Pjanic and I'm talking to people and I'm just like, oh, just go to Barcelona, you know, extend our tour, you know. And when there was rumors linking Bernardeschi to Barcelona, my heart was dropping, but I didn't want to say anything because it's almost unfashionable to believe in Bernardeschi, but he really is so smart and people think it's a mental block that he doesn't do well or whatever it is. But I honestly believe that he's a lot of the reasons why he hasn't progressed or done as well as we had hoped is because he's tactically flexible. And I just feel like he gets shoved into all these different spaces and roles and positions on the pitch. And he doesn't really have one that's defined and that's his. So it's like he's a false nine under Mancini. Sometimes he's the mezzala. Sometimes he's playing on the wing, sometimes in midfield. And it's almost like because he can manage so much, he doesn't really have the opportunity to show you what he can do if he had that consistency of one pitch in one position, in one position on the pitch. And I just felt like, you know, being given that chance again, he didn't at all look like he was short on confidence. He was happy to take his shots, happy to provide for Dybala and Ronaldo. And I'm really happy to have him back. But again, I look at this side and I think I'm worried about Lazio, but more importantly, like, do they really have a hope in hell when it comes to the Champions League?
I mean, that, a lot of stuff can happen in 6 weeks. That's a long, long way away.
But, and they've got a huge benefit in the Champions League because Lyon aren't playing right now. So the fact that Juventus will be well in.
But Lyon is just, it's one game. You know, what if they manage to get through that? And then what? Face who exactly? Bayern Munich?
Yeah, I mean, then they lose and then we all laugh at them again. look, I mean, I just stay in the present. You know my thoughts on Decilio and you know my thoughts on Danilo. And to see the one idiot get injured again for the 10 millionth time, really making me wonder, what is it? I mean, what is it with this guy? And then managed to get himself booked while also being injured at the same time. And then, you know, Tweedledum comes on for him and gets himself sent off. Now, if Conte were the manager, I think these guys would be little puddles of oil right now because he would have absolutely stomped all over them. But this is really bad. What happens now? What does Cuadrado switch over and play right back? Does Matuidi play right back? I mean, what?
I think it's Matuidi. I mean, it's your sacrificial lamb. Like, this is the thing that you still have to depend on these players, you know?
So and Matuidi, who's arguably Juve's most reliable midfielder, has to go and play right back. So you can play Rabiot or Ramsey.
Or Ramsey. Ramsey, who is also absolutely always injured. Rabiot, who I genuinely, if you can, I don't know, because I found a lot of people like praising him on Twitter. This is Twitter, of course. I'm sitting there saying, what does he add to the midfield? I'm yet to understand why. I mean, in the non-possession phase, I really feel like Rabiot may have 3 minutes of brilliance, but that's about it. It's 3 minutes of brilliance. I mean, he's a waste to play. He's a luxury to play. He doesn't provide anything. Khedira is now injured for the, I don't know how long. People talk about squad depth and then you look at this side and you think, I don't know, there's no left back now. So Matuidi is going to be sacrificed and what's going to produce? But there aren't that many big games, right?
Nikki, somebody asked me this, right? And maybe you can shed some light. Can you imagine if Juve had a youth academy and like an under or even an under 23 team with players that they could draw on occasionally? I mean, this is something I don't get, right? Because they've obviously spent a ton of money on youth development. And, you know, to their credit, they have an under 20. They're the only team in Italy that has an under 23 side that plays in the lower divisions, which they, you know, when it was rolled out, they told us about how important it was for development and stuff like that. And look, Real Madrid have one. Barcelona has one. But then these guys seem to, like they seem to never want to move these people up. And I don't know. I wonder if, like, right now, given the situation that we're in with the injuries, and might this not be a good time to go and draw upon this?
I mean, it's a great question about why Juventus don't produce more talented youth players, and that's a long-term situation. You really can't
for themselves, because they do produce them, but sometimes they go out and play for other teams.
That's true. But yeah, you know, you think, try to think of players who've come through that youth system and have contributed to Juventus' first team in a meaningful way in recent times. Yeah, well, how recent are we willing to call recent, Gab? I mean, he's not even there anymore. When you think about Juventus' youth system, what it basically boils down to is, you know, players like Dejan Kulusevski, who they've signed and then left at Parma until they plan to bring him in. Their own development for themselves is really sort of, I think it's strikingly disappointing when you compare it to clubs elsewhere in Europe, top clubs elsewhere in Europe. And I was just, because I was talking about him this morning, thinking about, for instance, Phil Foden and Man City. And I know people there feel like he, you know, he still hasn't sort of been properly integrated, got his chances, but at least there's someone who's part of something. And they're not alone, by the way. You know, we should stress lots of the bigger clubs in Italy could be sort of pulled up for this. Obviously, Inter have damned themselves quite hard by having Zaniolo come through and become such a talent at Roma, who they sent him off to for effectively peanuts in their Nainggolan deal.
But Zaniolo, of course, isn't really an Inter guy. I mean, they got him from Intella when he was young. Juve is that they've spent so much money on this, right? So there's obviously a willingness by the club, to go and do this.
Yeah.
But it just seems that it doesn't go through whether it's Allegri or Sarri, it doesn't seem to go through in the first team. And right now, you know, I'm asking myself, rather than moving my world champion midfielder into a position that's not his position and screwing up my midfield, just because in Italy we so overvalue experience, might I not be better off with getting a right back from the under-23 team, who, you know, is still a professional footballer right back who plays against third division opposition and is supposedly highly rated because he's a Juve player. Might I not be better off giving somebody like that a chance?
Well, this isn't the first time that Juventus have been without right back this season. Matuidi has had to cover in that role before. But I think the way that they've been looking at this when it comes to their under-23 side is not the fact that it's like La Masia, which they hope to eventually promote and integrate into the first team squad like Barcelona do. It's more a little bit like Madrid's youth team, which is a case of generating money, generating funds to then sell on, not necessarily players that they wish to bring on. That's the way that at least they have handled the situation behind closed doors, because it doesn't seem like many of these players actually believe in their chances to go up and start playing for this team. There isn't a cohesive movement going from start to finish in which how players progress up the ranks and then play for them. Even Ciro Immobile, who was one of the best strikers there, wasn't really given that much of a look in when it came in before he was passed forward. It's more a way of just generating money for them than on the 23 side. I don't think it's for sporting reasons. But again, you know, we talk about this, and it's a very good point about why can't we look at the youth team and actually promote players there. But I also have to ask, like, I forgot about Piazza, and I'm reading all about the fact that he's been sent back to Juve. So then you've got Piazza, you've got Douglas Costa, you've got Federico Bernardeschi, you've got about 1,000 players in the wide areas. And when we look in the midfield, you've got Matuidi and Khedira, who are, what, combined age of like 93, yeah? And then you've got Rabiot and Ramsey. Ramsey, you know, is injury prone. Rabiot, you knew was going to take time. Like, why are we continuing to buy even more players like Kulusevski when what was really necessary was perhaps to invest in the middle and create something and help for Pjanic, who, let's be honest, he has his moments and he's a very talented player, but he can't do it all on his own. And Bentancur isn't enough to just provide that. So there are question marks to be asked even in the transfer market. And even this season, it looks like they're not trying to go there.
Let's buy some more forwards. You've actually, like, you know, it's sort of extraordinary, really, like, that this conversation is even happening. So what we're talking about is gaps in Juventus' squad. And how many names have you just listed, Mina? I mean, there's not a shortage of bodies. There's an extraordinary number of bodies. The issue is something that we talked about even in the first place. We did talk about this over the summer, like this recruitment policy being driven by, oh, that's an interesting opportunity for someone who is out of contract, is not necessarily a very smart policy for building a squad that's coherent. You know, I don't necessarily agree, by the way, that Matuidi is what's going to happen at right back. I think Cuadrado is the more obvious choice, but it's true that you have a glut, I think an absolute sort of overabundance of bodies in midfield. And what you're saying is not we haven't got midfielders to pick from. What you're saying is we haven't got midfielders who actually do the jobs we need them to do. And that's pretty damning in terms of your recruitment, that you could bring in that many players. And then again, Juventus aren't alone in this. I criticise Roma for it, but bringing in that number of players without actually thinking about what you're going to do with them.
Yeah, and especially considering the kind of midfield that you had that was once occupied by Arturo Vidal, Paul Pogba, and Andrea Pirlo, and you could see how well and how fast they grew, and the team grew because of them. That is the engine of your room. You understand that you don't take punts just because Rabiot is available, right, and because Ramsey is available. You have to have a more cohesive unit.
So I wonder if Fabio Paratici is listening, because all I hear is continuous praise for the guy.
Definitely heard this from me, but yeah.
But one final thing, just Marco Piazza, you're right, Anderlecht haven't renewed his loan, but of course, just to clarify, he can't play for Juve until next season because of the registration window.
Yes, but it's just one other person in the wider.
Another body, yeah.
Absolutely. But I mean, you know, while there are question marks over them, they have extended the lead Juventus to 4 at the top, because Lazio are yet to play, obviously. But only, a little bit more points behind now. But Inter have now caught up because they beat Sampdoria. And they looked rather terrific. But again, I sort of want to turn around and feel like if I'm going to call it just Bologna, should I not also say this was a really bad Sampdoria?
Well, did they look terrific, or did they look like exactly the Inter that we've complained about all season, which is capable of playing brilliant football? And they did, you know, I've been banging on about it since we brought this podcast back, because you go back and watch Inter at the beginning of this season, they played some brilliant football. They played some beautiful football. But they also played some beautiful football in games where they were most ultimately disappointing, like the Borussia Dortmund game where you go 2-0 up for half time. But this is exactly what Inter do. They draw you in with this football that's really compelling and lots to like about it. I mean, Christian Eriksen looks very much part of that machine, which is a huge triumph for Conte to get that player who seemed like he wasn't really going to fit in very neatly when he was first there in January, to now be something integral, to be at the heart of these glorious goals. And I thought Inter's goals were so good in that game. And he teed Lukaku up at the beginning of the second half, what absolutely should have been the third. But then out of nowhere, concede a goal from a corner and spend the last half hour looking anxious, like you're going to blow it. I mean, I really thought they were going to blow it, and they didn't. But I don't know that that's much by design. I think Sampdoria weren't a good enough team to punish them for the way they were playing late in that game. So it's a mixed bag for Inter. You know, if you can get that performance that you got at the start of the game, and of course, I think with all of these assessments, still need to be forgiving, still need to understand that these teams are finding their way back from a really sort of tricky, unexpected pause. But if you finish every game like that, given that you are once again 9 points behind until you play your game in hand, you can't afford to throw points away the rest of this season. They're going to have to keep winning. And if you keep trying to close games like that, I don't think they will.
Yeah, but for a team that has the most amazing centre-backs, well, at least I think one of the best, you know, and they've got Lautaro Martinez and Romelu Lukaku up front, why aren't they killing off their goal-scoring chances? And why do they always look so nervous at the back as soon as they concede a goal?
I mean, it's a good question about why they look more nervous at the back. I think part of it, I don't know that they really look more nervous. I think they just defended badly in the last 10, 15 minutes, and they feel the pressure. And Conte creates this atmosphere of pressure. There's a belief, I mean, it's been a long-running thing with Italian players, is that when they feel under pressure, they end up performing better. You know, I mean, more broadly, even if we go back in the context of great Italian defenders in the past, or even today, Chiellini, right? Chiellini, when he's at his peak, phenomenal defender, but he does look always under pressure. He always looks like, you know, he's making a last attempt and usually gets it right, whatever. You know, even Maldini in his prime, I mean, maybe the one exception was Baresi, who always looked cool. But even Maldini in his prime, you know, he's all Nesta sweaty in like the hair and everything. Okay, but Nesta isn't a footballer. Nesta was a god among men. Okay, come down to earth. So the Nesta's a bit
also
different.
Looks- Cannavaro,
but you know, Cannavaro was always more the little guy bouncing around. But I mean, like, there is sort of I think especially with Conte, when you ratchet up the pressure, you know, it's not about being cool and seeing out games. I'm encouraged by this because they could have been 5-0 up easily, and they probably should have been. And they played really, really well. And you can say that it's only Sampdoria, but, you know, this is a Sampdoria team that was set up to defend by Ranieri, that's been doing much better under Ranieri. And they broke them down. It wasn't a team that played to Inter's strengths, perhaps the way Bologna might have. And I think, by the way, Bologna attacking Juve when Juve were down, I think was the right move. I would never, going back to that, I wouldn't criticize Mihailovic like some people have done. I heard some people on television, right? like Marocchi, who's always, he's got the worst of both because he's part Bologna and part Juve. So he's like, well, you know, I think, well, if you'd adopted Rino Gattuso style, Sinisa maybe putting 8 players in the box, you know, would have been, I mean, come on, man. Just go and play football. Bologna are in mid-table. They did the right thing. They went for it. It's also about actually playing games, right? But anyway, I digress. I'm encouraged because I thought they showed that they could play well. The stuff at the end, you know, it's not ideal, but that is part of what happens to Conte teams. Even when they're dominant, even the great Juve teams that he had that played with all that intensity, a lot of times those games were very close at the back, and it wasn't – I mean, I certainly – if I had I been a Juve fan, which, as you know, I'm most definitely not.
oh, I don't know. You're all picking them to win a lot of games. Yeah.
No, but let me ask you this, Nomina. You felt more reassured late in games under Allegri than you did under Conte, right?
Mm.
Partly because of the style of play, yeah.
Actually, I think that one of the things that people compliment Conte a lot on is the mentality that he supposedly brings. You know, he makes everyone so fierce and so desperate to win. But I think that you sort of hit, you touched upon it. It's a lot of pressure. And I think that it's really good when you're trying to win Serie A games when the opponents are Lecce or Brescia or whatever it is. And when there's a marathon season and you can make up for your mistakes like a league. But when you are putting that much pressure in a tournament, whether it's a Champions League or whatever it is, something that, you know, they're knockout games, I think that it ends up just rattling the squad. And that's what I feel like there's something there that it just seems like they always look anxious during the games. And Sampdoria were particularly poor in the first hour. And it's almost like as soon as they just slightly got better, and I've got to agree with Nikki here, as soon as they just slightly got better, sort of tried to push up because it was falling so deep at that point, it looked like they got nervous. And when you look at a side that is really, it has a lot of talent, that side, you know, from Martinez to Lukaku to De Bruyne to Skriniar. I mean, it's a great team. For you to look that anxious against these opponents who were so hit as well by COVID-19, who had so many of these problems, Ranieri has taken them from the very pit at the very bottom to just, you know, slightly up. I feel like it should have been not just a good performance. I think it should be a more efficient performance. That's always been my problem with Napoli too. They're very wonderful to play, but what I think Gattuso's brought for them, for example, is a little bit more efficiency, which Inter's lacking at times. But I guess, you know, like, you know, forgetting all of this for a second, I think something that we should concentrate on, and we've spoken so much about it between us anyway, is some of the goal celebrations we've seen, Lukaku and Kulu for Torino, for Black Lives Matter. How do you guys feel the Italian response has been to the cause?
It's been sort of less concerted or, I don't know, orchestrated at an organisational level, perhaps, for other leagues. You haven't got, for instance, what the Premier League's done with having Black Lives Matter on all the shirts, but it was definitely sort of supported and visible in these celebrations. There was what felt like a particularly unfortunate framing of Nkulu's celebration, which was the first one. That was the first goal scored after Serie A's resumption, was Nicolas Nkulu scoring for Torino against Parma. And, you know, he got all of his teammates came over to celebrate with him. And then as soon as he had a chance to disengage from that, he took a knee and raised a clenched fist. And afterwards he said that was, you know, in memory of my brother George Floyd. So he was wanted to center that very quickly, and I think Torino's Twitter account was quick to tweet out the photo as well, which I guess is a way of an organization showing the support. It did, I think, for a lot of people who weren't paying attention to that story, because I saw it being shared in some circles of American journalists and people who I follow on Twitter. Like, it was an unfortunate framing of that photo, because Nkulu was kneeling directly in front of Belotti, who was sort of standing over him, and then it sort of has this, you know, I guess, unfortunate way you can frame that as a black man kneeling in front of a white man, which I didn't think was anyone's intention. I don't think it was Torino's intention. It certainly wasn't Belotti's intention, who'd just been there hugging his teammates. So just for anyone who saw that and took it in a context that it was not intended as, that wasn't the purpose of it. The purpose was Nkulu making his, making his feelings felt. And Lukaku did the same thing when he scored. He took a knee and raised a fist. So there were those celebrations.
Yeah, I mean, I think Lukaku took a knee and did the raised fist, which, you know, is, I mean, Lukaku, I think, is a more intelligent, reflective person. And I think he saw what happened with Nkulu, and he made sure that there would be no room for anybody to misunderstand or misrepresent what happened. One of the issues with the Nkulu thing is that he literally only knelt down for a couple seconds. Mm-hmm. And it almost looked as if Belotti didn't know it was coming.
Yeah. I think Belotti didn't know it was coming. Like, the whole team had gone over to him to hug him when he scored, so.
Yeah. I think that same picture that the Torino, that Torino put out on their Twitter feed, for which they were very heavily criticized for. Part of me said, all right, well, if you had a bit of, you know, if there was more diversity in the Torino's social, people who run Torino's social media, they might have understood this better. But then I thought, you know what, it really doesn't take diversity to understand. Like, you don't need to be diverse to see that some people in this day and age are going to interpret that picture in that way. It's true, there weren't many other photos to choose from. You could have cropped the picture. You could have, might have meant cropping Belotti out of the picture. I think there was also a picture from Getty, which was out on the wires, which was from a different angle and doesn't look that way. It is a bit of a missed opportunity, and I think Serie A could do a better job of being aware of its legacy on these matters and people not really understanding it and, you know, rushing to go and defend. I mean, I made this point last night. You know, in the Premier League, obviously there was a White Lives Matter Burnley banner that flew over the Man City game. And you look at the reaction immediately afterwards of Ben Mee, the Burnley captain, which is, you know, who said that he felt ashamed and embarrassed. That was literally his very first reaction. You know, the first reaction when stuff like this happens in Italy, unfortunately, until now is, well, it's a minority. Those people don't represent us and whatever. No, those people, the minute they attach their name to you, the minute they're attached to you, they are, they're damaging you. They're damaging your image. And I hope that people at clubs in Italy can kind of understand, you know, this dynamic and how it works. You know, rather than going on saying, but we're not racist, nobody's talking about you, whether you're racist. The point is, these people have co-opted your brand, your symbol, and associated, you know, their racism or their abuse with your brand, and that should make you embarrassed, ashamed, and angry first and foremost. And so, you know, I think Benny's been applauded a lot, so I just wanted to add my own applause to him.
Yeah, no, that is a really great point. I just want to mention with the Nkulu point, it was a really badly framed picture, and I think that everything that you guys say stands, but he shared that picture, from what I understand, on his Instagram stories. I'm fairly certain I saw that. So it's almost like he didn't even see the offense in it. So he did share it on his stories, wanted to say that this was something for George Floyd. I think that, you know, sometimes you get swept up in the emotions and you're not perhaps looking at the optics of it, entirely. And, either way, I mean, it's not enough, but I mean, wouldn't it be just fantastic if we had more Ben Means who spoke about this in the way that he did? I totally agree with that.
Well, one other thing that I think is worth mentioning, obviously in the Premier League, the league kind of took over and wrote Black Lives Matter on the back of people's shirts and has everybody go and kneel down. I'm in two minds about this. Some people say, no, this is good because it normalizes the message. I'm not so sure. I kind of feel a little bit like the poppies on the shirts when it becomes a corporate message and it's sort of co-opted by the league. You know, we've also seen people run around in, you know, anti-racism t-shirts and then they don't really think about it anymore. So personally, I would much favor, you know, individuals who go, or even collectives of players of their own accord, rather than having their employers saying, yeah, we're going to go and do this, even if it's something coordinated with the players, which is something that it was a case in the Premier League. But I think this is going to become more powerful when we actually have a player who is not affected by the Black Lives Matter message, i.e. a white player, come out and celebrate this way. And I think, you know, I was always struck by how, I'm sorry if I digress into the NFL, but Nikki's with me. After Colin Kaepernick, shortly afterwards, you had Megan Rapinoe going out and also taking a knee, who is,
yes,
you know, not just is she not black, she's also not a man. And, you know, I know I've been told, I don't know if this is true, that Daniele De Sena, had he scored last night, and he came very close, you know, he would have done it. I think there is a group of players in Serie A who are not players of color, who are going to do this if and when they score. Unfortunately, looking at the cohort of players, many of them aren't likely to score. But I think if it does happen, I think that does send an important message that this is something that, while it obviously affects the black community, there is a role for allies in this as well, for people who feel like that they want to share in this.
Yeah, absolutely. And I did think Dybala spoke about this really well. I feel like if Chiellini ever manages to get a goal, then he'd be the first person showing off a t-shirt and being supportive.
Yeah, there have been some you know, white players who've spoken out this and quite eloquently. Giorgio Chiellini, before anyone came back, was posting on social and talking about how difficult he was finding it to explain what was going on in the world to his daughters, but how important it was. And you think about, you know, I think for some white players, it's just a question of how you show your support without trying to center yourself. And I think about Peter Norman on the podium in 1968 and his decision not to raise his fist in solidarity with Smith and Carlos, but the nevertheless standing in solidarity with them. And you read about the conversations he had with them and what he did to sort of be with them privately and to respect what they were doing and support what they were doing, but not to make it about himself. I think that's a conundrum sometimes for white athletes. You know, they want to support it, but they also don't want to take away from it in some sense by making it about themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. That's so well said. I think that is something of a dilemma for certain players trying to address this. But we do have a big game coming up to change things up, which is going to be a game that can tell us a lot about what happens, not only in the title race, but indeed in the position, in the top four positions. We have, of course, have Atalanta and Lazio facing off on Wednesday evening. Now, this is going to be super exciting because we know that Atalanta are back to their usual. They smashed Sassuolo after what looked like a shaky first 10 minutes. And you thought, oh, this is a bit strange. Maybe they're feeling, you know, the effects of lockdown and they can't really regain their fervor. It was only 10 minutes, of course. And then they did regain everything. There wasn't Ilicic there, but they managed to score four goals. Juvan Zapata was wonderful. He managed to get a brace, whereas Papu Gomez, who also loves Sassuolo, always manages to do something special against them, was brilliant all round. And this is going to be super exciting because we've got the two top assist makers facing off against one another in Luis Alberto and Papu Gomez. And no one knows what to expect because no one's seen Lazio play. We know that obviously Atalanta just look like they're just rolling forward. You know, nothing has changed anything for them. Always a side that can entertain with scoring goals. But can Lazio regain that ability to really dazzle us again and play that vertical, astonishing, swashbuckling football?
I mean, I think on paper, the contrast between the two obviously makes for an interesting game. I would definitely lean Lazio at this stage. I thought were brilliant. Yeah, Atalanta were brilliant against Sassuolo because of the... But that's also because, you know, Sassuolo play very open attacking football. And I think that suited Atalanta. I mean, Atalanta could have scored five goals by halftime. But I think there's going to be a couple key elements missing for Atalanta. One is obviously Ilicic. It sounds like he might come on as a sub, but that he's not match fit. Obviously wasn't there against Sassuolo, but Lazio aren't Sassuolo. I also think Pasalic, who's suspended, is going to be a big loss for Atalanta. And then, of course, there's the manager.
Now, yes, he's suspended.
You know my thoughts on this guy. Hats off, brilliant. But he's also got serious issues. How you can get yourself sent off when you're 4-0 up. By the way, that also applies to the Muppet from Juventus who got himself, the guy who got himself, was he booked or sent off early in the game last night? The Juventus team, Fabrice, whatever his name. Who is that guy? Like, how do you possibly, nobody knows who the hell you are, right? You're sitting with your stupid mask on, like, three rows back, and you get yourself in trouble early in the game? What is your problem? Anyway.
Okay, but I feel like Gasparini is a bit worse.
Yeah, but the other guy plays for Juve, so it kind of balances out. And also Gasparini is Juve ties, as you know. But no, but
this all has to do with the fact that I said you're a Juve fan. Now you're really going to attack them, right?
But I think this is part of the reason why Gasparini and big clubs wouldn't stand for this level of idiocy, this level of all of a sudden the guy gets, you know, his head gets so into it that he loses control. You cannot get yourself sent off from the bench when you're 4-0 up. It's not possible. I don't know how it's going to impact them.
Can I just for a second, I think that that's what makes them actually brilliant. I know that you're looking at this and thinking, if you're really smart and you want to be, you know, the coach of a big team, that this is not how you act because, you know, like, look at what's going on. You're up 4-0 against Sassuolo. Yeah, fine. But I also think it's the fact that he treats every game like it's the world's most important game that makes Atalanta so special. That's the reason why they've scored 74 goals this season. It's why they take every game seriously and not just like how PSG are sometimes when it's, oh yeah, so this is Dijon, no one cares, this is so-and-so. They care about every game, and I think that's what makes them special.
He was sent off for abusing the VAR at 4-0.
Yeah, but
now, I'm sorry, but like, what is the, you know, like,
I love the passion. I mean, I'm sorry, we sit there applauding Conte every time he does his passionate pleas. I think this is wonderful to watch. Yeah,
how often does Conte get sent off?
Not very much. He's a bit cleverer.
Antonio Conte was saying loudly some things that were picked up by the microphones pitch side that perhaps one shouldn't say when there's microphones right next to you. But
But he's not being abusive towards an individual. I know what you're referring to.
He's using
a lot of really bad language, but he's urging his players on, right?
Yeah,
he's
absolutely.
Not being abusive towards an individual or giving people grounds to send them off.
I think it was... It looks bad for Gasparini. I think it's stupid, and I think it hurts his team in a direct way. I think if a player did exactly the same thing, if a player got themselves sent off and 4-0 up in a game, was going to miss next game, you'd call them out for it. Yeah, you'd chew them out because it's stupid. It's completely unnecessary.
I think it's because the next game is Lazio. I think that's also what it is. Like, if the next game was perhaps something against, you know, Brescia, you'll be like, all right then, you know. But
we criticized Danilo earlier for sent off, right? I don't know who his next game is against.
We criticized Danilo because Danilo is the token for every winning team. He's just there. No one knows what he does. You know, he was there in Madrid. You know, he was there for Manchester City. He's sitting there collecting more trophies than Lionel Messi, and no one knows what he's doing. So it's Danilo deserves criticism all round because
he's
yet to understand what his actual role is in any team or what he has contributed to any of these winning sides. This is what I like, look at your team. You can see the fact that there is no, you know, basically no fullback available. So that is more idiotic for me. You know, at least Gasparini is trying to rally the troops. This guy, I don't know what he's doing, you know. But I want to talk about the fact that this is purely going to be an interesting game, but do you think the fact that there isn't going to be they're not going to be any fans in the stadium. Will this take something away from this match? And will this harm any team? Well, we've seen that Atalanta can do it without people, but what about Lazio?
I mean, I thought that was, you know, you just mentioned it, but that was one of my takeaways from this weekend was how, and I would say actually in contrast to some football that I've watched in other leagues, like I didn't feel like the absence of fans this weekend reduced the intensity of any of the games that I watched in Serie A or on Monday night. I felt like all of these games were played to a high level of intensity, were played to a good quality, actually, a surprising level of quality. Yeah, there was some patchiness, as certainly Atalanta at the beginning of their game against Sassuolo. There were some very loose passes, but very quickly I felt like we were back in the room, as it were, that we were back where we were. And I mean, who knows, because we haven't seen Lazio back yet. And certainly I think it's a little bit of a disadvantage to Lazio for a very important game to be the team coming in without having played yet. I know you could turn that around and say, oh, Atalanta be tired, but I don't think you're tired after this long off. I think you're happy to have that run out in your legs and to feel that sort of first game shaken out of you. So I think that could really hurt Lazio. But the lack of fans so far, I don't feel like has been a factor in the performances of the teams on the pitch. Maybe it affects how we experience it as fans, but I think the players have looked pretty on it so far myself.
Okay, now one team that I can definitely guarantee has not been affected by the fact there are no fans. I don't know whether it's because of the opponent, but Milan were really value for money in their game against Lecce. They obviously managed to get 4 goals. I don't know whether this was because Çalhanoğlu had the game of his life and he was just astonishingly good to watch and he contributed to all 4 goals. Rebic finally got onto the score sheet despite the fact that there's no Zlatan Ibrahimovic. But I don't know whether this is owing more to Pioli's tactics and the harmony of the team or whether Lecce just kind of played a really reckless game where you're a little bit like, maybe you should pay attention to the defensive side of things. Yeah. Is this still Serie A?
Can I be like a little bit like, and Cap can get contribute in a second, can I be like a little bit of a Debbie Downer with Milan? Because I saw some response to this game. They were like, oh, this is the Milan that we haven't seen in how many years. Milan, like, conceded a goal in the first half that was a very, very marginal offside call. They, you know, had review on it wasn't a penalty, but on a possible penalty. They weren't, like, completely in control of this game. They let Lecce equalise, and then, yeah, they had, like, a strong finish. But Lecce, as you say, Mina, were pretty open and just aren't a very good football team, being brutal about it. So I'm not saying don't take any positives from it, of course. For Milan, any sort of win like this, it feels like it's been a long time. But I'm maybe a little bit easier on the gas with the sort of celebrating this as some dramatic turnaround moment myself.
I don't think it's a turnaround, but I mean, you know, I'm not going to blame Lecce for going for it. They're at home. They need 3 points. And again, it's the same main argument with Bologna, right? You're playing a big team. I want people to show some balls and to go there and try to win the game because you need 3 points. And Milan, you know, they've had all their issues. And so why not go for it?
My issue is that I feel really sorry for Stefano Pioli because it's like before the match, we were sitting there asking him, you know, so what's going to happen with Ralf Rangnick coming in? You know, what's going to happen with your job? And he has to sit there and say that we're all professionals and all of this business. After the game, they win. It's a really great victory. Everyone's really excited. Çalhanoğlu's had a great game of the season. Rebic is so happy and enthralled after everything that he went through in the Coppa Italia. And again, it's what's going to happen with Ralf Rangnick? And it's like, once again, we're going to go through this of constant rebuilding. How can Milan ever really take it up a notch when they're constantly talking about what's going on upstairs? I just feel like it's become a situation that is like Groundhog Day for 4 years, where we can't really talk about anything, whether it was Gattuso's Milan, whether it was whoever's Milan, Giampiero's Milan, and now with Pioli. It's constantly talk about what's going to happen next and boardroom level and who's been fired, who's going to come in, which sporting director's unhappy. And I don't really see, like, there's just no point almost discussing what happens on the pitch because everything that happens upstairs eventually takes its toll on the team. But, you know, I mean, Milan are not the only side that are having problems when it comes to management because obviously, as we all know, the sporting director of Roma, Petracchi, has also been suspended from his role. And there's a lot of question marks over what's going on at Roma at the top level. And I mean, I don't know. I mean, Nikki, you said last week that you have a lot of time for Pelotta. I feel like the way that he explains himself on things and questions regarding the team, I always feel like his explanations are really interesting to listen to because he speaks from the heart and you can understand the logic behind it. But, you know, I mean, Fonseca seems to be so excited about Serie A. He keeps talking about what an attacking league it is. And yes, obviously people do know how to defend, Lecce aside. But do you see this as a team that really has a hope of pushing into the top 4?
Yeah, I mean, I also said at the same time as expressing the things I liked about Pallotta that perhaps there have been some missteps, especially in directorial appointments. And, you know, because there'll be a whole separate big conversation going to this specific one. Certainly the sporting director role has seen more turnover than you would like over the last few years. And I think there's going to be more. So it's not ideal in terms of pushing on to the top 4. Look, the gap is 6 points right now. They might have an opportunity if Lazio go and beat Atalanta to close that gap. So relying on their neighbours, which they won't particularly relish. There's a lot of season left. I think that's the thing which people are still missing with Serie A. At the moment, most teams still have 12 games left to play. And that's a lot. That's almost a third of your season still to go. So there's plenty of time for Roma to make up that gap. 6 points is not an abyss. That's something that can be bridged. I'm just being realistic. I think it would be extraordinary if Atalanta don't drop more than 6 points from here to the end of the season. But obviously, Roma have less margin for error. We haven't seen how they come back from this break yet. We do know that Nicolò Zaniolo has just had his first game back with the youth team, so that's a very encouraging step and something that wouldn't have happened if the season had finished on its usual schedule. So that's encouraging for them, but we need to see them on the pitch. We've seen Atalanta on the pitch, and it looks a lot like Atalanta before the break. So the bar is going to be, I think, pretty high for Roma when they have the extra points to make up.
I think they're still in with a good shot to make the top four. I think he's perfectly right. 12 games is a lot, and let's see how things work out. The Petrachi thing, we think we said it on our first show back, that you know he was about done. And you know, you can go back and question the issues with the directors of football that they've had, but equally I think everybody in the world was saying that Monchi was one of the top three guys out there. So you can go back and look about why things didn't work out, maybe how he got to be one of the top three guys in the world, and whether that would fly at Roma. Hopefully they learn from their mistakes. Hopefully they find a buyer, and they move on.
It's interesting because, you know, Napoli were a side that were having the most problems at the top level at the start of the season. And obviously everyone remembers De Laurentiis and all the fines and then the change of coach and all the problems. But Gattuso did in fact win the Coppa Italia, and it was just pandemonium in Naples, and not exactly good for a country that's just gotten through a pandemic. But either way, they deserve a chance to celebrate what has been a difficult year for them. But Gattuso looks like, you know, the team is thrilled. Callejon was in tears at the final whistle. Is this, you know, the last trophy that he might win with Napoli? Is he going to stay? Is he going to go? But for them, they just look like a team that's so happy with one another. That's just like, you know, that it's almost like they're the pineapple of Real Madrid. You guys remember the pineapple of Real Madrid that, you know, they referred to themselves because of the harmony in the dressing room as the pineapple. And it is a team that won three Champions League finals. And I just feel like there's that good energy going on at Napoli at the moment. So if there is a team that I'm going to think might push into the top four, my money's on them.
I think they're definitely in with a shout. I think they're a deeper team than people realize. And I think also, you know, Gattuso, that is one thing that he brings to the table. You know, he's a good guy. People like him. And, you know, but also he's not afraid to crack the whip, as Chucky Lozano found out. Now, part of me says you invested all this money in Lozano, and I find it absurd that there can't be a role for him. But obviously we're not privy to the internal dynamics of the team and what went on, and maybe Gattuso made the right decision with him. But I think certainly they're definitely, I think even more so than Rome, even though Napoli are behind them, I think Napoli are in with a legit run at the top four. And I would have never expected to be saying that back in December.
So despite what I said about the amount of time there is left in the season, I mean, Napoli do have an extra 6 points on top of what Roma have to make up. So it's 12 points, which is a lot. They're actually, by the time you're listening to this, they may have closed that a bit because they're playing a few hours after we record. So we don't know.
Against Verona, Nikki, against Verona.
Yes.
Verona who play every day.
Yes, Verona who seem to just be constantly on.
It does seem like that.
And playing well. I will say one other thing that works in Napoli's favour at this point is that winning the Coppa means that they are in Europe. Like, that's guaranteed. So they now have total freedom for the rest of the season. Like, they can go for that Champions League spot without feeling any pressure about it because they're not expected to get it, and they've already got the other thing that they could seek to achieve this season. So, yeah, they have a free hit for the rest of the season, which, who knows, could play in their favour.
Yeah, that's interesting. But we are... we're coming up to your favorite segment, Nikki. It's the knee-jerk reactions. Serie A is indeed back. And there were other matches that happened. Obviously, there was Torino and Parma. There was Hellas Verona that seems to be playing forever in every match. But what are your knee-jerk reactions coming out of this week? What do you think about the games that happened?
I mean, the most important knee-jerk reaction is that we've got this segment back. Because last week, I angled for my knee-jerk reactions. And I was told, no, we've done enough. We don't need to do it. So I've got my segment back. That's the most important one. But for me, actually, I've already touched on it. But I think my biggest knee-jerk reaction, honestly, is just that before this all happened, when we got those first few games behind closed doors, I really felt like it didn't work. I felt like there was a loss of something. There was a loss of intensity. The games didn't feel like proper games. And it's still not the same as having fans there. Of course, all of us prefer football with full stadiums, with the atmosphere that brings. And let's all hope that we can get back to that as soon as possible in a safe way. But my knee-jerk reaction, honestly, is that I've watched these games over the weekend and on Monday, and I felt them as every bit as intense as they needed to be. I felt them as games that mattered, that this was going to be a real conclusion to the season, which we didn't always know it was going to be. I think a lot of people for a while really thought that this season would not pick up and we wouldn't get the conclusion to this incredible title race that has been this, you know, serious race for the top four with Atalanta pushing on again and perhaps the conclusion to the Champions League story as well. So yeah, that's my knee-jerk reaction, is that City is back and it's wonderful, and maybe there's even some extra fun to be had for a few weeks of listening in on all the sort of sideline colourful language and phrasing that we get from one or two of our favourite protagonists as well.
I feel like Gab is really listening to all of the things that are being said now that he doesn't have to hear the crowd noises. Gab, what's your knee-jerk reaction?
I think mine is simply that we're, I don't know, it's kind of, you know, restating the obvious, but we're in total uncharted territory here with the fact that we've got so many games to play and the games are coming all one after the other. I think this means that we're going to get some unusual results between now and the season. We'll get twists and turns. And I think what we're also going to see from certain sides, and I think this is really good because this is not what we got in the past. I think the absence of the crowd is actually going to get sides like Sassuolo, like Bologna, sides in mid-table, maybe later on sides that are already relegated, to say, screw this. Let's go for it. Let's play more attacking football. Let's not have this fear of failure, which we so often see, or late in the season in Italy, you know, between teams that have nothing to play for. Oh, let's just, you know, slow it down, get a point each, and, you know, and that way the fans won't complain. I think we're going to see more interesting things happen, weirdly, between now and the end of the season. And, you know, it's going to come with a big giant asterisk because at some point things will go back to normal. But I'm really curious to see how things work out.
Yeah, I mean, even Brescia, you know, played a good game, or at least tried to. When it comes to my knee-jerk reaction, I do want to, because I don't think we spoke enough about him, but I do want to tip my hat to Lautaro Martinez. There was a lot of talk about the fact that whether the rumours of Barcelona have gotten to him and he doesn't, you know, he's not able to score the goals. He hadn't scored, I think, from the end of January, and it was a match against Cagliari. So well done to him for getting on the score sheet. But for me, it's actually Torino, because I sort of lost faith in them. I thought that, you know, Walter Mazzarri left, they brought in Longo, and I just thought, is, you know, they seem to be on the lookout for another coach. Were they going to get Semplici? Were they going to get somebody else? But I actually thought they played a good game against Parma, missed a lot of chances. And I guess my only thought is, Simone Zazan, what's happened to this player? He was once upon a time going to be this great striker, and now he's just somebody that can't convert anything. But anyway, I don't know why.
Once upon a time, you're going way back, yeah?
I mean, yeah, we really are. We really are going way back. But it's just a shame to see him, like, you know, not being able to take any of his chances. But this has been the Serie A Awesome Podcast. There are so many matches coming up, of course, none more exciting than Atalanta and Lazio facing off on Wednesday night. There'll be so much more. So join us next week, where Gab, Nikki, and I shall discuss all that and more. See you then.